There has been, sisters, since the latter part of the 7th century to the latter part of the 20th, in 14 centuries, there has been no deviation from this liturgical ritual. Zero, none. I'm not praising its woodenness. I am praying its sense of unity, which is of the essence of the liturgy. Unless you have some external unity, you don't have the liturgy. That's what I teach when I teach the theology of the sacraments. The essence of the liturgy is the manifestation of external unity. It is also public, besides having a uniform, and therefore there is public in the sense of something which is uniform for the whole Muslim world. It is done at prescribed uniform times. Now clearly, the sun keeps rising and the sun keeps setting around the world. Thus Muslims keep worshiping and keep worshiping God from sunrise through sunset, which of course for the world at large is for 24 hours. Allah therefore is assured worship from Muslims around the clock, which to my sorrow I say he does not always get from Christians. And when I talk ecumenically, and here I'm talking ecumenically about the Eastern religions, we have a lot to learn, an awful lot. Set times for prayer are at daybreak, and I've got the numbers there. I hope they're accurate. You might watch them. 2 rakahs, noon, 4, mid-afternoon, 4, after sunset, 3, and in the early part of the night, 4. Let's count them. How many are there? 17. Okay. Please, 17. Okay. Prayers may be said in private or preferably together with a congregation in a mosque. There's no mosque around? All right. But it's together. When said publicly, the worshippers stand in rows behind the prayer leader, called the imam, roughly the Muslim priest, all facing in the direction called Qibla, Q-U-I-B-L-A, of the sacred mosque at Mecca, which is east depending on where you are in the world, marked by a niche in the wall of the mosque, to make sure they don't miss their compass directions. Private recitation should be on clean ground or on a rug, if the ground, of course, is not clean, in the direction of Mecca. I've met men on planes, believing Muslims, who carry that little rug along. And I am shamed to the marrow of my bone when a Muslim pauses to worship while I'm in conversation with him. Sisters, may I repeat, we can learn a lot from other religions. And what's happened, of course, in the still so-called Christian West, so much of this West has no faith. And we are struggling for survival. That's why correctly, and I say this, maybe the only chance I'll have to say it, I think the future of Christianity lies in the East. And I don't think I'm pessimistic when I say that a large part of the West has had 2,000 years of chance, and so much of it has lost that chance. In this, I am quoting no less a person than my own superior general. Close parenthesis. Fridays at noon is the main ritual service of the week and consists of a formal address in two parts. Invocation of the prophets, or part invocation, invocations of the prophet, quoting his invocations, not invoking him. Muslim leaders and the political ruler of the state. In other words, various invocations, either by them or prayers formulated by them. Then a sermon delivered by a preacher. Similar major functions are held on the two principal feast days of the year, so they have their holy days of obligation. The day of the breaking of the fast, after the fast of Ramadan, which we're going to talk about, a whole month of fasting, and the feast of the sacrifice at the pilgrimage, which is, of course, to be done in Mecca, if possible, or done sacrifices may be offered elsewhere. Hours of prayer, and if you've been in Eastern countries, they are announced by a caller, Muezzin, or Muezzin, M-U-E-Z-Z-I-N, sometimes simply Muezzin, from the minaret of the mosque. That's the function of the minaret. He follows this formula, and I'm told they don't vary too much. God is most great. God is most great. I bear witness that there is no God except the one God. I bear witness that Muhammad is the prophet of God. Come to prayer. Come to the good. Good is capitalized. It is, of course, the beneficent one. Prayer is better than sleep. God is most great. God is most great. There is no God but the one God. I hope you won't forget the phrase, prayer is better than sleep. No reflection, just an observation for all of us human beings. Elaborate provisions require cleansing before prayer, whether in public or private, as prescribed in the Quran. When you rise up to prayer, wash your face and your hands and arms to the elbows, and wipe your hands and your feet, and wipe your head and your feet to the ankles. Another so-called greater ablution must be performed after major pollutions, when a person does something very wrong, breaks a fast, or does something which is against Quranic discipline. The purification should be done with water if they have it. And of course, so much of the Orient, especially this part of the Orient, where Islam is strong, then use clean sand. Curiously, the rite of circumcision, though it is generally binding on Muslims, is nowhere prescribed in the Quran. Now the legal almsgiving. Two forms of ritual donation are mentioned in the Quran: free will offerings and mandatory contribution. Now when I say ritual, I mean just that. And this is again something which, as you know, Protestants have had done much more with than most Catholics. About the only ritual connection is that the money usually is taken up around the time when the offertory takes place. The latter, that is the mandatory contribution, zakah, Z-A-K-A-H, I have it, I think, mentioned somewhere, is gravely prescriptive as an outward sign of piety and a means of salvation. In juridical theory, the zakah is exacted on grain, fruits, livestock, silver, gold, and merchandise, and amounts to about 1/40 of the annual revenues. Though not called a tax, it is required of all who, whether voluntarily or otherwise, enter Islam, and consequently Christians too were subject to that tax. And of course it could be increased at will. As stated in the Quran, the beneficiaries of these alms are the poor, the needy, those employed in collection, persons engaged in propagating religion, slaves and prisoners, insoluble debtors, fighters for the faith, and travelers. The Crusades were financed by the zakah. In Muslim countries, the zakah becomes formal taxation, and this is the general pattern. Most Muslims are in Muslim countries, and if they are not, they try to make Muslim countries of the place where they live. This, as all Christians ought to know, is the ideal, because as I said, there is not church and state union in Islam. In Islam, church is the state. In other words, the highest, we can speak of it, ecclesiastical authority, or the progenitor of the Prophet, of the great Prophet Muhammad, is or should be the civil ruler. And consequently, the free will offerings of those who are Muslims are in addition to that which they are supposed to pay or must pay. And once a country goes Muslim, then everybody else must pay his taxes according to the zakah. And what happened for centuries, and still happens, in Muslim-dominated countries, one of the easiest ways to squeeze Christianity out of existence, which happened, for example, in Turkey, which happened in most of northern Africa, there is almost no Christianity to speak of except such as there is in Ethiopia. It was done by the simple expedient of taxing them out of existence. And what happened, of course, and this is one of the tragedies among the Eastern emperors who became creatures of the sultans, who after the conquest, as you know, of Constantinople, the Muslims said, well, let's not be silly. Let's not put the Christians out of existence. That would be very bad business. Let's control them. They want their faith. Fine. Let them pay for it. So they did with their blood. I forget the exact figures. I don't have it in front of me. But I think my figures are that in a given, let's see, what is it? I think it's about a century, less than a century of the worst period of the relationship between the Eastern Church and the Muslims. I think it's something like 60 or 67 years. There were 100 patriarchs of Constantinople. Some just a few weeks in office. And almost none of them died a natural death. In other words, creatures of the state of the Sultan states who either went along with the Muslims and bled their own people almost to death to pay the heavy taxes which the Muslims exacted for the practice of Christianity, or if they didn't come through or resisted, very simple, they got somebody else. Let me just, again, this is an aside, but it's important. We're studying, I hope, comparative religion, and by making asides, it's not really asides because I think it's essential. This kind of thinking of the domination up to the time of Muhammad of the church by the state was what was indispensable historically for Islam having ever come into power. Muhammad could not have arisen simultaneously as a prophet and a conqueror unless for almost six centuries before him the people of the East had been used to that. They had been used to that, of course, from the ancient Roman emperors who, as you know, were literally deified. They became the famous divi gods. Talk about union of church and state. When you worship Nero as one of the gods. And then, of course, over the centuries, the control of the church by the state among the Christian emperors. And you know the trouble, for example, that the Christians in the East constantly had. And then when it came to the break between the East and the West, see, it's the same language, just to know this. And to know this is a constant struggle, a struggle in the East, a struggle in the West. We're no different than they. The state constantly seeking to control a society, in this case Christianity, which claims by divine sanction to be independent of the state. What belongs to Caesar, give it to him. What belongs to God, give it to him. And Caesar dare not dominate what belongs to God. At any rate, I want to have you feel this, so that in this business of legal almsgiving, it is the usual means used, besides killing those who ran into or who opposed the progress of Islam. The rest became enslaved, mainly through zakah. Now, fasting. In its earliest form, fasting was prescribed by Muhammad at Medina in the same form and on the same day as for the Jews. So it used to be pretty much the same. And we can read in what we find of the fasting laws, rather draconian, as you know, in the Old Testament. Things you may not eat. That was at first the original teaching of Muhammad too. Muslims, that is among the commentators, observed that until a medication was revealed, quote, Muslims used to fast completely from the evening meal of one day until the evening meal of the next day, that is on fast days. And if they fell asleep before they had taken their meal, they considered it their duty to abstain, with the result that men fainted and came near to death. Intercourse with their wives had been similarly restricted, with obvious consequences. Given the revelation, however, which was occasioned by estrangement from the Jews and the growth of Islamic independence, the form of fast became optional, and the ninth lunar month each year, called Ramadan, was made a period of strict observance. Ramadan, then, is the month, one lunar month of strict fasting, which obligates all Muslims everywhere. It affects them in sound health once they have reached maturity. The exempt are old, sick travelers, women, for example, pregnant and in certain conditions. But the exemption lasts only as long as the disability. And if you get well after Ramadan is over, well, you pick up where the month left off. Breaking the fast is punishable by fines of expiation of different quantity depending on how much you have broken the fast. It consists in complete abstention from food and drink, tobacco and perfumes. Perfumes, as you may know, in the sweltering East, for very good reasons, and sexual intercourse from sunrise to sunset of each day of Ramadan. There are no prohibitions for the night, but by that time, I'm told, you hardly enjoy your food, and you may be almost at the point of exhaustion from not having taken a drop of water in a hot Sahara desert for 16, 17, until sometimes, depending on the night and, of course, the latitude, hours. Other fasts of greater or less intensity are also part of Islamic custom, for example, to expiate certain offenses and before certain feast days. Now the pilgrimage to Mecca, where I have more in your notes, I will spend less in expatiating. Much is fasting as a result of contact with the Jews. So the pilgrim, Haji, H-double-J, which may always be pronounced Hajj, H-double-J, to Mecca, from which, of course, the Hajira, the flight, derives its name. In other words, it is a pilgrimage to commemorate the flight. It is a pilgrimage to Mecca, which became part of the Muslim religion through their relationship with the pagans. Now let's get the context. The origin of this pilgrimage, on one side, and historically, derives from Muhammad himself, having come back to Mecca, which is his birthplace. His pilgrimage, if you wish, a fighting pilgrimage, a hard, bloody one, see, is to be commemorated. So that's the historical context. These circumstances and the practices are derived pretty much from the polytheism or even the animism of the people of that time who did indeed make pilgrimages and even to Mecca. The ritual itself has been taken largely from pre-Islamic paganism, but now, of course, thoroughly purified and directed to the worship of a single deity. At least once in a lifetime, every Muslim is expected to go on this pilgrimage to the sacred mosque of Mecca, and it should be in the month of pilgrimage, which is the 12th or last month of the lunar year. Physical strength for the journey and the necessary finances are assumed to make the precept strictly binding. But I'm told it is unbelievable the sacrifices that believing Muslims will make to make sure they have made this pilgrimage. The immediate object of the pilgrimage is to kiss the famous black stone that Arabian polytheists had worshipped for centuries before Muhammad came on the scene. Other ritual ceremonies are stoning of the pillars, which represent the devil in the vicinity of a place called Mina, nearby, the offering of sacrifices of sheep and camels on the way back from this town. So it's a pretty expensive pilgrimage, because they are your sheep and camels. Visiting the mosque and going seven times around the Kaaba, K-A-A-B-A, which I hope is mentioned, is it? The former animist shrine, running between two small elevations outside the sanctuary and visiting the Prophet's own mosque at Medina, which is not far away. If the distance between Mecca and Medina is considerable for, say, an Arab, nevertheless, remember, this is all on that postage stamp country called, you might say, the Old Palestine. Essential to the pilgrimage are the afternoon services held at the Hill of Arafah, about 12 miles east of Mecca. I think all of these are somehow mentioned in your notes. Elaborate ritual purifications are required before entering the territory of Mecca. Men shave their heads, discard their ordinary clothing, and put on two plain, unsewn sheets. And I'm told there's all kinds of gear on sale, and you can imagine, tens of thousands in 28 days, maybe several million, to take care of those people. Have you ever seen pictures of the pilgrimage to Mecca? It's as far as the eye can reach. Just tens of thousands of people living in tents or temporary shelters. They leave their hand, face and head uncovered. Women keep their head covered. No fasting is prescribed, but the use of perfumes and, during the pilgrimage, sexual relations are forbidden. The two most significant effects of the pilgrimage, I'm reading two in here, my eyes are getting a little blurred, has been, the most important effect has been to consolidate the Muslim community and to give the pilgrimage a new sense of belonging to the elect. It is the nearest thing to a sense of predestination among the Muslims. The title he requires, the Haji, where the accent is on the second syllable, H-E-J-J-I, adding the I to the other word, pilgrimage. The title this, which he acquires, on returning home adds to his prestige and personally assures him his salvation. And that's why, my friend, Dr. Lowe says, I have been to Mecca. He has made it, both here and hereafter.